Just give me your name, age, and hometown.
Morris Magnuson, here from Sioux Falls. I'm 86 years old.
Well, thank you for your service. And what was your branch of service rank and the unit you served with?
I was in the Air Corps, Army Air Corps at that time. And I went in as a second lieutenant after finishing flying school. And was at the time I was shot down, I was a captain in the Air Corps. And I stayed in the reserve and served out, was a lieutenant colonel in the reserve.
What did you get drafted? How did you end up in the military?
No, I enlisted. I always wanted to be a pilot. And I was out in California at the time. And when I saw the P-38s out there with the trim boom, I thought, that's what I want to do. And of course, I ended up as a fighter pilot, but had one tail instead of two. And but I was really pleased that I was able to be a fighter pilot. So that was my goal.
What were the fighter planes at that point?
Which ones?
Yeah.
Well, the first ones really were used in China, Burma, the P-40. In fact, I flew a P-40 as in my transition training in flying school. But the P-47 was just developed, as was the P-51, and they were the two major ones that were used in the ETO, in the European Theater of Operations.
So when you say you wanted to be a pilot, that was something just as a young child, or how did that interest develop?
Pretty much as a youngster in high school, I guess. I'd never had a ride in a plane until I took my first flight in a primary flight trainer in a PT-19, Ryan, with my instructor behind me and me in the front cockpit. This is cool. We didn't use the word cool at that time.
But the flight must have went all right.
Yes, I guess so. It did. Primary was a really critical part of your training, and there were some of them that washed out within a week or two. And about, probably a third of them were washed out there that it didn't have the coordination or the attitude or the ability to adapt to flying. And so I felt fortunate to get through it. It was always quite a step when we graduated from one phase of it, primary, and then go to basic, and then to advanced, and then into the real Air Force, and really got into it.
How many months, years of training do you, how long is flight school?
Well, I had what they call pre-flight. They were lined up. They had more than more cadets than they could handle at that time. So I went to pre-flight, and it was over a period of about a year and a half, I guess it was. Mm-hmm.
And then once you graduated from that, what happened then?
Well, we were sent to a transition. When we received our wings and our bars, second lieutenant, we were assigned to a transition at Harding Field in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And that was where we oriented and learned to fly the P-47. That was about a 2 months assignment. And from there, they put us on the Queen Mary, and we were over in Europe in 6 days. And then we had a little additional training there in Scotland, but then we were assigned to our fighter squadron. We were assigned as replacements, replacing fellows who were killed or missing, and joined them there in Ashford, England, which is right near the White Cliffs of Dover.
Mm-hmm. What, at that point, you were 18?
No, I was about 20. 22, I guess, at, 23 at that time.
What was your perception of what war was all about at that point, before you actually got over there?
We Really didn't know. We heard a lot of kind of horror stories about it, and then of course the newsreels were carrying quite a little of what it was like, and we never had a chance to really visit with any returning veterans who had actually been engaged in combat over there. But when we joined the squadron, they had flown, many of them had flown 15, 20 missions, and of course they were the veterans at that time. And it was one of, well, I don't know, you just kind of stand in wonder of them, and we knew we were in for a long, tough haul. And we had to, of course, mentally, we were geared to really fight. When we graduated from flying school, we got a letter from our commandant out there. He told us in detail, you know, how we're going to have to serve honorably in the Air Corps. But down at the bottom were these words, kill or be killed. And that was one thing we went with that aspect. Our assignment was really to kill Germans and wreck their war machine. That's what we had to do.
And they had quite a war machine.
Yes, they did. They had the Luftwaffe with the 109s and the 190s was a really a match. In fact, more than a match for the British forces there. And Great Britain really were on their knees at the time that Pearl Harbor and the U.S. entered the war, and they got the United States behind them there, and that really turned it around.
And what were your missions like then? You were flying from England over into Europe.
Yeah, our first ones were flying escort for the bombers, mostly B-17s out of England. They were in the 8th Air Force, and they were flying raids on, well, a lot of raids in France hitting military targets there. Might be anti-aircraft or gun emplacements or troop concentrations, and quite a few hitting factories over in Germany. And of course, the P-47 was a kind of a gas hog, and would only fly about 2 or 2.5 hours on gas, so that we couldn't escort them clear to Berlin, which they kind of wanted. So early on, probably in May of 1945, we were assigned to tactical work, which was attaching us to the infantry and the tanks and the others in France. And this was just prior to the invasion. But then we
So
went.
that would have been about 1944 or early 45.
1944. Yeah. So then we were assigned to these strategic missions where we hit anything that moved over there, really, in France or Belgium or in Germany. Troop concentrations, railroads, marshaling yards, occasionally barges on the rivers, and gun emplacements, and all of those things. Troop concentration. Probably the hardest part was flying against a mission where we were going on against troop concentrations, men and equipment, where we used the napalm bombs, which were a firebomb. Terrible. It was tough hitting those. But we realized, as the colonel told us when we graduated, kill or be killed. So we were doing our part.
It's hard to adjust to that, though, at some level, isn't it?
You know, Germany was really a kind of a Lutheran-based population. A lot of Lutherans there. And I was a Lutheran myself. And I say, gosh, I hate to kill off all these Lutherans. But I guess I better do it.
Yeah.
So that was it.
And how many missions did you
Apparently,
complete?
Yeah, I flew 80 missions. At that time, the bombers were flying about 25, and then they would go home. They were longer missions and so on, and they were tough missions too. But with the fighter planes, we flew 60 missions, and then we could go home. But when I finished my 50th mission, a friend of mine had been burnt badly in an aircraft accident, takeoff accident, and we'd been together all the time from the time we were. Went in as civilians until we were together flying over in from out of England and France. And he said, we've been together all this time. Why don't you volunteer for a few more missions? We'll go together, go home together. And I said, well, that'll be a good idea. So I volunteered to fly 20 more, which made it 80. And of course, it was on my 80th mission where I got shot down.
And you could have gone home earlier.
Yeah, I could have.
But you volunteered, and then that was the fateful mission. What happened?
Well, I was leading a flight against an airfield near Gießen, Germany, and we had a flight of I think it was 16 planes there that was hitting that airfield, and I had we came over the airfield there around 10,000 feet, and I told the squadron to circle while I went down with my wingman and looked things over. And we went down, and they really weren't expecting us. There are a lot of planes on the ground, and there are a lot of fire too. They had a lot of armament protecting the airbase. But we dropped our bombs, the two of us, and strafed some planes, and I pulled up, told them to follow me through. We're going to wipe them out. And of course, the second time I came across the runway there, probably about 100 feet high, they got a direct hit on me, and so I had to pull up and flew just a little ways to the west toward the Americans, and then the engine quit, and I had to bail out. I should mention to you, too, that the P-47 was really armed. We had 450 caliber machine guns in each wing. And they concentrated at about 170 or 200 yards ahead. It was really power. You could just knock out things like a train, a locomotive, blow it sky high, especially if they had a head of steam on, or trucks or tanks, anything like that. But I bailed out and was able to evade the Germans initially. By running.
How did you do that?
When I bailed out and hit the ground, I ran into some woods, hid my chute, and then I started west, right into a German patrol. They started shooting at me. I turned around, went back in the woods, and I ran for I don't know how far, as hard as I could go, and outran them. And this was 11 o'clock in the morning. But when I got so tired I couldn't go any further. I crawled in some brush and thought I'm going to have to wait them out. And they beat the brush around there all afternoon for me. And long toward the latter part of the afternoon, they brought in, I heard bloodhounds baying, and I thought, oh boy, I've hit it now. But this was in March, and there was some, quite a little, had been quite a little melting and some snow on the ground. And evidently, I'd gone through some little streams and some mud puddles. The bloodhound never did pick up my trail. So, after they had searched around and had the bloodhounds looking, they finally gave up and left. And I started my journey back to the American lines, 100 miles. I had an escape kit and with a map and a compass and things like that. But it also had a peanut bar in there. About like what you buy now for $1.50, and I cut that into 8 parts. I figured 100 miles, I can make it in eight nights. I travel just at night. Germans all around, and of course, things went pretty fair until the last day. I encountered a lone German in the woods there, and we had a shootout there. He shot me just a flesh wound in the leg, and I shot him in the shoulder, and he took off one way, I took off the other. But that night, I figured I'd be back with the Americans, and And so I started out and hadn't gone more than an hour, half an hour or so. I walked right into a patrol of five Germans and had to give up. They really caught me stone cold there. And from there, I was in three different prison camps at Wetzlar, Nuremberg, and then finally down to Stalag 7A, where I had a lot of company, 77,000 in that prison down there. And I was there until we were liberated in April 29th, I think it was, in 1945.
How do you navigate at night? Were you able to keep a sense of where you're going, the right direction?
It was tough. It really was. You couldn't hardly see anything. And of course, going through the woods, I tried to travel carefully and silently. You never knew. In fact, I walked right up into and touched a German Jeep before I realized what it was, where they were camped, back off. In fact, one night it was a night I saw the Jeep. I came down this little, kind of a little trail, and came up on that Jeep, and I realized that I was right there in a camp. So I went out, and I crossed a stream and made a big swoop and crossed another stream and came to a little trail and started down that the same darn Jeep. I made a big circle. So after that, I'd use my compass regularly to keep a heading there in the west. But it was tough to navigate. I didn't know for sure just where it was, although I knew I had to go west 100 miles.
And you must have made it okay without injury from the landing?
Yes, I got out of that okay. We had instructions on the parachute. You never had a chance to try it to see if it would work, you know. They told us how to do it. And they always said that when you come out of P-47, it's the best to fall out on the wing and then go under your horizontal stabilizer, you break your legs. Well, when I was evidently going faster than I thought when I bailed out, and I just unhooked everything in the cockpit and kind of stood up in the seat there, and whoosh, the air just sucked me out of there. I don't know whether I went above it or behind it, but anyway, I wasn't injured getting out of the plane, and the swing. Well, I didn't have too much altitude, probably 500 feet, and I just swung a few times and landed, but it didn't hurt me at all.
So you have a parachute that's kind of helping you at that point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's just already deployed, you already have it out?
No, it's when you have to pull a ripcord. It was a seat pack, yeah. And you have to rely on the parachute packers that they would do a good job, and when you pull a ripcord, it will work. They always told us. Now, if it doesn't work, you bring it back, which was good, good strategy.
It's just a lot to panic about in that whole situation, though, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I think I credit my survival to good training, and I guess we develop a good attitude. I was probably scared to death, although I don't really remember that when going through this. But you do things right, and it paid off to where you get out of there without any particular problem. And
you heard someone's voice in the back of your head, even how to make sure you didn't break your legs coming out of the plane.
Right, yeah. And, of course, we always shared stories. After missions, we shared stories and close calls and those things. And actually, we didn't realize it at the time, but we were learning from that and remembering it for when we might need it ourselves. That's kind of what
And I would imagine lots of those planes would get shot down.
Yes, we had, out of our squadron, we had about 48 pilots in our squadron, and about half of them were killed or missing in action. So the odds weren't very good, although we all thought, well, 50-50 chance I'll survive. And we didn't talk much about that. Someone would be missing in action, or maybe we even see them bail out and shoot didn't open, or they may just stay on the plane and go in with the plane. But we would grieve for them and talk about it for a day or two, but we realized that our job is to continue flying. It was kind of tough. A lot of good friends that went. Yeah.
What was it like for your family back home? Did they find out that you had been shot down?
My folks received a telegram shortly after I was shot down, the first part of, or in the middle of March, that I was missing in action. But it said that I still have a copy of that, but they said that no one saw me, which is understandable. You know, when you're hitting an airfield like that, after they start in, you've got planes and smoke and bombs going off and lots of action and excitement, and no one noticed me go off here to the side in my plane going. So they didn't know what had become of me. During all the time I was in prison camp, I wrote them through the Red Cross, but they never received those letters until I got back home. But my folks and my girlfriend at that time didn't know what happened to me until about the middle of June, almost 3 months later, when we landed in New York, and I called them, and I said, I made it. Yeah. So it was quite an interesting homecoming. My mother handled it pretty well. There were three of us boys in the service, my older brother in the Air Force, and he was in North Africa and flew a lot of missions there, and wasn't injured or anything. My younger brother was in the Navy. He was on an aircraft carrier and had to swim for your life when that was shot down. So, my mom had a lot of faith in that fact that her three boys would come home.
Did you have sisters?
Yeah, he had one sister and then a younger brother.
What was the experience of being a prisoner of war like?
Well, we surely didn't look forward to it, and it was a little tough, a little tough. We didn't get much to eat, and we had a lot of company though. We had lice and ticks and bed bugs, and 77 other prisoners there with us. About all we talked about, not girls, but it was about hamburgers and molded milk and passing the time. Yeah, but
Where was your family then at that time in California?
no, they were in Washington State. My parents were South Dakotans. They were raised and lived here, and they moved out there while I was in the service. But
And why do you want to share your story with high schools in the area?
well, there seemed to be a need for them to know what war is like, and what it's like to be in there. And many questions I get: how in the world could you do that? Here, you're a young man, only in your 20s, and you go through all that. How could you do it? And I said, any one of you students here, if the United States was attacked tomorrow, I say you would find that you would be ready to fill in that need there as much as I was. And I remember Bob Dole saying, he was a survivor of World War II, and talking about the greatest generation, he said that's really not true. It was just happened that we were the generation that were called upon at a certain time to do a job, and that's what we did. He said he feels that if we went to war any particular time, that those young men would do the same thing and be able to do it just as well as we did.
And you agree with him?
I think so. Yes, I think so. It's one of those things where depending on the circumstances and the situation, you arise to that.
You have a sheet here with some of the information you share with students. I notice you have some adjectives there about war, just to help bring it home for them, I guess.
Well, yeah, I don't know. These pretty much came from the students, I guess. And here are the things that they describe war. I guess I helped them a little bit. Terrible, bloody, scary, dangerous, destructive, perilous, ugly, costly, exciting, challenging, dramatic, frightening, dumb, idiotic. All of those things, it describes war. It's a most wasteful, most wasteful thing we can ever do. But how are we going to avoid it? I don't know.
And then what did you do after the war?
I went to South Dakota State and went into education. I taught and was a secondary principal and then a superintendent of schools and a superintendent out at many years out at Brandon Valley. And I stayed in the reserve and had an active part in the Air Force Reserve.
Anything else comes to mind that you want to add?
Not particularly, I don't think. I guess kind of covered. There's a lot of detail, but
I'll make a copy of that too.
oh, okay. Yeah. You know, one thing I didn't describe to you. When we were liberated on April 29th, 1945, probably one of the greatest experiences that you could ever imagine. And you may want to scan. I've got a picture, actually it's a copy, of the prisoners who were freed from Bad Ord, Germany, at about the same time we were. But it just happened that there was probably an army photographer there that when they opened the gates, it takes a picture of them. And here come these fellows who are just freed. And I pass this around occasionally and tell them to look at their faces to see what real happiness is. I'll show it to you. It's really something. But when the American troops came in and the German guards threw their guns down, and the first thing they did was to pull down the swastika flag, the Nazi flag, and pull up the American flag. There are many that just openly broke down and cried. It was very touching. Yeah, to be free.